Tales of grand heists and elaborate scams have long captivated our imaginations, and among these daring exploits, one story stands out as particularly audacious: the tale of a self-proclaimed countess who dared deceive none other than the Queen of France herself. This daring escapade took place in the luxurious French court of the 1700s, where Jeanne de Lamotte, a noblewoman fallen on hard times, or so she would say, orchestrated a very daring scheme to steal a lavish and extremely expensive diamond necklace. Through a web of cunning lies and manipulation, the so-called Countess managed to eventually get her hands on the coveted jewels. However, her triumph was short-lived, as the aftermath of the scandal sent shockwaves through the French monarchy, ultimately contributing to its downfall. Today, I'm telling you the story of the Countess who duped the Queen, a scandalous scam that forever altered the course of French history. Hi everyone, and welcome back to Haunted History, and a very happy 2024. It's a little delayed, but that's okay. I hope everyone has been having a great year now that we are already 3 months in, and it's almost Easter, which is crazy. And it's even more crazy that it's been like 17 degrees over the weekend where I live, and that is pretty darn warm for March. So I have a feeling like this summer is going to be a hot one. I am super excited to be back and to be recording again. I think it was good to take some time and kind of assess the direction that we wanted to go in. And one lovely surprise is that I noticed through our break, we've had even more listeners tune in. And it just makes me happy because I know people are really interested in the stories that we're sharing, and it makes the work that goes into it worth it. So thank you guys again so much. And if you haven't already, give us a follow on social media at Haunted History Pod. We really do love connecting with you guys, and it's a great way for you, you know, to share any feedback or your thoughts on episodes or hear what we have to say from time to time. So our schedule is going to be slightly different in 2024. New episodes of Haunted History will be available wherever you find your podcasts every third Tuesday of the month, starting today. Now, it's been a minute, and I'm sure you're getting anxious to hear today's juicy tale. So I don't want to ramble too much. Why don't we jump right in to today's story? Our story begins more than three decades prior to the scandalous affair of the diamond necklace, with the birth of Jeanne de Valois de Saint-Rémy, and I think I said that correct, in the quaint town of Fontette, France, in the year 1756. And when I say quaint, I really do mean quaint. I think it may even be appropriate to call it a community. I'm not actually sure if it even qualifies as a town. When I was looking at the populations, it was only 228 back in 1962, and it's fluctuated only slightly since. So I'm guessing in the 1700s, it was probably less, 100 or maybe even less. It's a time fraught with political and social turmoil. The Seven Years' War had just begun, a conflict that spanned continents. Europe, India, and North America had become the battlegrounds for the fierce struggle between France and Britain, as they both vied for supremacy in the acquisition of colonies and the lucrative trade routes that they offered. For many of us, I'm sure, it's hard to fathom the hardships endured during such a tumultuous era. However, for Jeanne, the protagonist in our story, life proved even more arduous due to her family's precarious standing. Let me explain. She was born into the lineage of the esteemed House of Valois, her father Henry tracing his ancestry back to King Henry II. Now, you might be thinking, but Megan, she comes from a royal family. She has to be blessed with good fortune, right? After all, her ancestors, the House of Valois, had reigned as a powerful royal dynasty for over two centuries, ultimately propelling France to the zenith of European dominance. However, you'd be mistaken. as fate had a different story to tell. Her royal ancestor was the son of the king's mistress, rendering him and his lineage illegitimate in the eyes of society. And thanks to period dramas, I'm sure you too are also familiar with the treatment of bastards back in the day. Wasn't too great. Now, this doesn't mean that they were destitute. On the contrary, Jeanne's ancestor, the first Baron de Fontette, would have at one time possessed some wealth, lands, and other valuable assets. However, as the years wore on, and by the time we get to Jeanne's generation, the money dwindled, and all they were left with was mounting debts and financial ruin. Her father could have easily joined the military service, like all of the men in the family before him, and quite frankly, he should have. That would have earned them some wealth and lands, but he had no interest, and that is when the finances really started to dwindle down. It's said that Jeanne and her family lived in extreme poverty. Records vary quite a bit, some claiming she was poorer than a servant, and others saying she wasn't that poor. So it's important to keep this in mind when hearing about her upbringing. A little later, we'll also talk about her publishing her memoirs, and there are several accounts that come from that. So we can't say for sure what the actual truth is, but as you'll come to find out, she doesn't have the best track record with honesty, so you can just keep that in mind during our story. Not only was Jeanne's family dealing with financial ruin, but it's also said that her father had a drinking problem, and her mother, who worked as a servant in the court, was prone to violent outbursts. The children frequently went without food or clothing, and it was even said that they didn't wear any shoes. They often just went barefoot and had to resort to begging on the streets just to survive. According to Jeanne, she endured several beatings from her mother, especially when she didn't beg effectively. Jeanne's father passed away while she was still a young child, leaving her and her siblings in the care of their overwhelmed mother. Eventually, unable to handle the responsibilities, their mother abandoned them, leaving them to fend for themselves with an uncertain future ahead. Life for street children was incredibly difficult, and Jeanne wasted no time in proudly proclaiming her noble lineage to anyone who would listen. She would share stories of her prestigious ancestry, emphasizing that she was one of the last remaining descendants of the esteemed Valois bloodline. Eventually, Jeanne's passionate pleas caught the attention of the respected Madame de Boulainvilliers. The Madame graciously offered Jeanne some protection and tirelessly worked to secure the recognition that Jeanne desperately desired from the crown. Jeanne's genealogy was investigated, and pretty soon it was confirmed by a genealogist that she was indeed descended from royalty. As a result, she was granted the title of Mademoiselle de Valois, a name that exuded regal splendor. She also received a modest yearly allowance as a token of acknowledgement from the crown. However, her heart was still filled with discontent. She believed that her noble bloodline entitled her to even greater rewards and treatment. The harsh truth was that her lineage was tainted by illegitimacy, casting a shadow over her aspirations, and ultimately the crown felt that the allowance granted was what was deserved. Now that her lineage had been authenticated, Jeanne found herself prepared to embark on a life befitting royalty. She quickly and effortlessly adapted to the luxurious lifestyle, indulging in lavishness that far surpassed her means. Unfortunately, this extravagant existence led her to accumulate a huge amount of debt, causing her to come up with clever strategies to finance her luxurious desires. Jeanne resorted to offering sexual favors, bribery, and blackmail, just to name a few. This is about the time when she begins engaging in various lower-level scams, such as defrauding jewelers through purchases on credit and then selling the goods for cash later. Unfortunately, her reputation preceded her, quickly introducing society to her questionable way of life. However, having a less than desirable reputation did not discourage Jeanne from pursuing love. And at the age of 24, she unexpectedly crossed paths with her future husband, Antoine Delamotte, who was also known as Nicholas, which is how we'll refer to him in this story. Jeanne and Nicholas were married in 1780, and Jeanne was heavily pregnant during their ceremony, so I think we can safely assume that this was the reason for their rush to the altar. Soon after marriage, the couple began proudly presenting themselves as Count and Countess de Lamotte, and unsurprisingly, he willingly joined forces with Jeanne in her schemes, setting the stage for their most daring scam to date. I say unsurprisingly because first, when Jeanne meets him, he claims that he has noble lineage, but she later finds out that he's lying. He created this facade, and he also had a bit of a reputation for being sleazy with deals and money and gambling. They get married, and then they both decide to call themselves Count and Countess, which obviously both are neither, so it really makes you wonder if their similar moral compass was what attracted them together in the first place. Not long after her marriage to Nicholas, which again I can only assume was out of some kind of necessity to hide their indiscretions, tragedy struck the couple as their twins died just a few days after birth. This tragedy caused Jeanne to battle bouts of depression. Soon, however, maybe in an effort to suppress her grief, a new forbidden love story unfolded as she began a secret affair with Louis-Marc Antoine Retaux de Valette, who, oddly enough, happened to be a childhood friend of her husband, Nicholas. Although Valette was from a noble family, he was of a much lower status, so he relied on his charm and good looks to entice noblewomen to the luxurious brothels of Paris. Jeanne found him irresistible and made him her personal secretary, and ultimately, he became her confidant. As Jeanne's desires grew, Nicholas's inability to fulfill his wife's extravagant wants became increasingly apparent. This is where Jeanne decided to take matters into her own hands. Immersed in the grandeur that surrounded her, she made the risky decision to seek more financial support from the royal family. With Queen Marie Antoinette's reputation for benevolence and Jeanne's own royal lineage, she believed that a grand restoration was within reach. Despite nearly bankrupting herself, Jeanne maintained a regal facade, using her small allowance to purchase lavish clothing and flashy silverware, only to quickly sell them off later. Her determination to capture the queen's attention led her to even resorting to theatrical fainting spells in front of high-born ladies. However, her frustration only grew as she realized that she was not the only one vying for the queen's favor within the halls of Versailles. Jeanne quickly began brainstorming a new and creative strategy, and luck was on her side this time when a fantastic chance arose. She devised a brilliant plan to convince the court of her unbreakable friendship with the queen. She strategically arranged meetings with the gatekeeper of Marie Antoinette's residence and would be seen coming and going at all hours of the night, painting a picture of a strong friendship with the queen. Without speaking a word, she watched as gossip spread like wildfire, and before long, Cardinal Rohan, a key player in this notorious scam, soon heard whispers of Jeanne's illustrious connection. Jeanne's grand plan was unfolding perfectly. Now, let's get to Cardinal Rohan. His grand entrance onto the scene was nothing short of dramatic. Coming from the esteemed and prestigious lineage of one of France's finest families, the cardinal had the potential of power and promise. His aspirations were lofty, much like Jeanne's, as he was aiming for the coveted position of prime minister. Yet there was a significant obstacle in his path: Marie Antoinette's dislike for him. Prior to her reign as queen, Cardinal Rohan had expressed doubts about her marriage to King Louis, a sentiment that would not sit well with our future queen. Consequently, Marie Antoinette had banished him from court, a decision that left him devastated. The cardinal's fall from grace was a severe blow, some deeming it socially unrecoverable. Determined to regain her favor, Rohan found himself in a desperate pursuit to win back her affection and approval. His once grand ambitions were now overshadowed by the need for her acceptance. Before long, the ideal chance arose. Jeanne discovered that her longtime friend and ally, the Madame de Boulainvilliers, was residing with the cardinal. This sparked a flurry of ideas in Jeanne's mind. With rather cunning ingenuity and utilizing the resources readily available to her, Jeanne approached her lover, Villette, seeking his help. Renowned for his exceptional skill in forgery, Villette possessed the remarkable ability to flawlessly replicate the Queen's distinctive handwriting. And what an interesting skill to have. I think it's safe to say that this wasn't his first time. So she entrusted him with the task of meticulously crafting counterfeit letters from the Queen, which they intended to deliver to the Cardinal. The ultimate objective of this plan was to deceive the Cardinal into believing that he had regained the Queen's favor. As the ruse unfolded, the fake letters gradually transitioned from pleasantries to requests for financial assistance, subtly coaxing the Cardinal into extending small loans. To their delight, I'm sure, the Cardinal willingly complied, shelling out a substantial sum of money under the guise of aiding the Queen and fostering a closer bond with her. Never one to miss an opportunity, Jeanne decided it was time to escalate her scheme. She wanted something bigger. She wanted the coveted Bomer and Bassage diamond necklace. Let's shift gears for a moment to the exquisite necklace that I'm referring to, because it's important to acknowledge that this piece of jewelry was no ordinary necklace. Crafted with the utmost precision by the crown jewelers, the necklace was made with a staggering 674 diamonds, amounting to a remarkable 2,842 carats. Additionally, it was adorned with 100 lustrous pearls, each diamond and pearl being meticulously sourced over the course of several years. The price? A staggering 1.6 million livres, an astronomical sum during the 1780s. In today's currency, this would be worth over $15 million. The necklace was originally intended for Madame du Barry, the mistress of Louis XV, but as fate would have it, the monarch passed away from smallpox before it was completed. A couple sources even state that it was never commissioned by the king. The jeweler made it on chance, hoping that he would purchase. But personally, I can't see that amount of money on chance, but who knows? With the king gone and no sale, the talented jewelers responsible for its creation found themselves facing financial ruin, desperately seeking a buyer. Despite their persistent efforts to entice Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette into acquiring the necklace, their advances were met with rejection. Marie Antoinette was simply not interested. Many speculate that it was the queen who declined, asserting that what they truly needed were not diamonds, but rather an additional fleet of 74 ships. Others, however, believe that her aversion stemmed from her disdain for du Barry and her reluctance to possess anything that was originally intended for her. Now that we know the enormous stakes at hand, this is where the plan begins to unfold. The first step was to spread a rumor that the queen desperately wanted the necklace, but given the state of France and the hefty price tag, she couldn't just go to the king for the money, as he would have most definitely disapproved of such an unnecessarily large purchase. Cue the gossips of Versailles. They completed their part in Jeanne's scam in record time, and eventually word spread to the jewelers that the queen was in fact interested in the necklace. As one might imagine, they were ecstatic and ready to swoop in with an offer. The second step was to craft a forged letter to the cardinal from the queen, stating how much she needed the necklace, listing all sorts of reasons why it was perfect for her and she just had to have it. And most importantly, She needed his help attaining it. The cardinal, unfortunately for Jeanne, felt like a favor of this size and the fact that the queen was confiding in him must have meant that she was in love with him. So he demanded to meet with her. Well, fearing that this was the only way he would be willing to help with the request and feeling so close to the diamonds that she could almost taste them, Jeanne thought of a very clever way to arrange a meeting, or so the cardinal thought. Jeanne and Nicholas, who by this time had fully immersed himself in her plan, enlisted the services of a prostitute named Marie-Nicole d'Olivia to act as the queen. Now, it seems like it would be a very bold move. Impersonating a queen would surely have some hefty consequences, but it's thought that she was under the impression that they were just playing a prank on a friend and that she really wasn't aware of the bigger picture. That evening, she was adorned in an elegant white gown and had a few key pieces of jewelry. She now had a striking resemblance to the queen. She met with the cardinal in the palace gardens and presented him with a solitary white rose. And for those well-versed in the language of flowers, this gesture conveyed the message, "I am deserving of your love and devotion." Well, the cardinal, completely deceived by the charade, fell head over heels. And I know it's like, come on, how did he not know? But in his defense, it was night, it was very dark, no city light ambience, you know, that we have these days. And at that time, they drank a lot. They were drinking wine all the time. So it was probably a bit tipsy, if anything, to keep the nerves at bay. Of course, we'll never know, but that's what I've been telling myself as to how he did not know that it wasn't her. The cardinal would soon find himself inundated with more letters from the queen, each one expressing more and more her desire for the Bohmer and Bassange diamond necklace that she said would just perfectly adorn her neck. It was clear to the cardinal now that she had her heart set on this extravagant piece of jewelry, and she must have it. Now, to the average person, this would raise suspicions. After all, the cost of the necklace was exorbitant. But the cardinal, being familiar with Marie Antoinette's extravagant lifestyle, really thought nothing of it, a mistake that he would surely later regret. He knew that she was notorious for her excessive spending and accumulating massive debts. So when she finally mustered the courage to ask him to purchase the necklace on her behalf, using his credit to keep it a secret from the king, he didn't hesitate. The cardinal agreed to buy the necklace for a staggering sum of 1.6 million livres, which, by the way, was actually a discount that the jewelers had given. And it was to be paid in 4 installments. The contract, meticulously drafted by Jeanne, was delivered to the cardinal. Little did anyone know at the time, but there was a tiny detail in the contract that would eventually lead to Jeanne's downfall: the signature. While the queen had only ever signed her first name, Marie Antoinette, Jeanne had made a rookie mistake, having it signed Marie Antoinette de France. After the necessary paperwork had been signed, the deal was done, and the jewelers proceeded to present the necklace to the cardinal, who was entrusted with delivering it to the queen's valet. Now, the queen's valet was none other than Valette, aka Jeanne's lover. When the three were finally alone with the necklace, Jeanne's husband and Valette began dismantling it in order to sell the individual diamonds. And I must say, what an interesting dynamic. Jeanne, her husband, and lover all working together on this scam. I would have to assume that at this point the affair was still a secret, and the prospect of that amount of money trumped any awkwardness. So after a few days passed, both the jewelers and the cardinal started feeling very uneasy, as the queen had been seen in public many times without wearing the necklace. Their anxiety reached its peak when the first payment was due. Jeanne wasn't able to come up with the amount for the first payment and informed the cardinal that the queen needed more time. This news worried the jewelers, who decided to approach a woman named Henrietta, the queen's lady-in-waiting, and reveal the secret transaction in hopes of gaining clarity as to why the payment had not been made. It's crucial to highlight that at this particular moment, it became evident that Zhen possessed a considerably larger sum of money than she previously had. She was extravagantly splurging her wealth as if it were flowing effortlessly through her fingers. Her purchases were beyond extravagant, including hot air balloons and a remarkable mechanical bird capable of actual flight. It would have been prudent for Zhen to exercise restraint in her spending in order to avoid raising any suspicions. However, driven by her impulsive nature and overwhelming excitement, she found herself unable to resist indulging in her desires. And I really have to wonder why she didn't sort out this part of the plan a bit better. Eventually, it would have come out. It was only a matter of time, and she was clever, so she had to have known this. But instead of taking her portion and fleeing, she stays around and just spends crazy amounts of money. I will always question why she didn't just leave when she had the opportunity. The events reached a critical point in August when Henrietta, aware of a significant fraud, decided to approach one of the king's ministers to disclose the information that she had received. Cardinal Rohan was summoned before the king and queen for questioning, initially appearing bewildered as he tried to justify his actions on behalf of the queen by presenting the letter where she had supposedly requested the necklace purchase. However, the king's anger flared as he pointed out that the royals only ever signed their first names, and the signature on the letter read Marie Antoinette de France. Once the fraud was revealed, the cardinal was swiftly sent to prison, sparking the beginning of a thorough investigation. In no time, the cardinal shifted the blame onto Jeanne, Nicholas, Valette, and D'Olivia, leading to their arrest and subsequent imprisonment as they awaited trial. The gravity of the situation demanded a thorough examination of the facts and a fair trial to ensure that all of those involved faced the consequences of their actions. The trial commenced in 1786 and quickly became the talk of the town, captivating the public's attention. It was a sensational event that the tabloids eagerly exploited, setting up camp outside the courtroom to cover every detail. Surprisingly, Jeanne found herself with a significant number of supporters rallying behind her cause. The public and the media of the era were relentless in their efforts to portray the queen as guilty, blaming her extravagant spending and the deceit for the suffering of the French people. But despite the mounting pressure, Jeanne maintained her innocence, insisting that she was merely following orders on behalf of the queen, even in the face of conflicting testimonies. In the aftermath of the trial, D'Olivia, the prostitute hired to pretend to be the queen, was declared innocent. Valette, the lover and forger, was exiled, and the Cardinal Rohan was acquitted. Jeanne's husband Nicholas, who had long fled to London by this time, was charged with missing the trial and sentenced to be flogged, branded, and to serve life in the galleys, which really was a terrible punishment, being sent to the galleys. It meant that you were sent to row on a ship, so you were an oar prisoner, just spending your life rowing out at sea. Sounds terrible. Even though Nicholas had a harsh punishment, ultimately, the brunt of the blame fell on Jeanne, who was sentenced to public humiliation, meaning she would have been stripped naked in public and beaten with sticks and whips, then branding, which was when a hot iron was used to make a stamp or mark into the skin, and in her case, it would have been the letter V for the word thief in French, and lastly, a life behind bars. As her sentence was being carried out, Jeanne fought fiercely the whole way, so much so that the executioner botched her branding. Instead of being branded on each shoulder, in the struggle, he ended up missing and hitting her chest. Jeanne's time in prison was short-lived, before she, of course, as our ambitious Jeanne, hatched a daring escape plan, ultimately disguising herself as a man and successfully fleeing to England. Soon after her arrival in England, she shocked the Queen of France, and I'm sure most, by announcing her intention to publish a memoir, painting the Queen as a villain and herself as the victim, coinciding with the Queen's own troubles of accusations of treason and subsequent house arrest. Now, I want to take a moment to talk about her memoirs. It was first published in French and then in English when she was in London, and I'll just give you a quick rundown. First, I do want to point out that she expresses herself really very well and in great detail, and she definitely paints a very vivid picture of her life and wants us to believe this captivating story that she's telling. She views nearly every single person in her life as a villain, and she's the victim. And she uses this as justification for her actions. So she sees her mom as wicked, money-hungry, didn't even show grief when her father died. She also claims that she was beaten. And this unfair start in life is one of the main things that she was seeking justice from. She also claims to have had no involvement in the actual theft of the necklace, and that she was acting on behalf of the Queen, all while painting the Queen as a very wicked person who needed to face the consequences for her greed. So my take is that the memoirs were essentially a way for her to attempt to absolve herself from any wrong and pin the blame elsewhere. And it did work to her advantage because the French people, who were looking for more reasons to hate the French monarchy, ended up jumping on board and taking her side. 2 years later, Jeanne's story took a tragic turn when she met a mysterious death, with conflicting reports surrounding the cause, some suggesting foul play rather than a mere accident. One theory is she battled depression and committed suicide, which Nicholas said that she had threatened in the past, one time in particular right after her twins died. Another theory is that she was murdered by royalist sympathizers. Given the circumstances at the time, it's not all that far-fetched, and there were also some reports saying that she was mangled and disfigured to a degree that was inconsistent with a fall from a window. Ultimately, though, it was ruled an accident. She was hiding from a debt collector, and in an effort to escape him, she jumped from her hotel room window, breaking several bones and knocking an eye out of her socket. She didn't immediately die, unfortunately. She was taken to the hospital, where she would die from her injuries a few days later. Her untimely end, at only 35 years old, left many questioning the true circumstances surrounding her demise, adding a layer of mystery to her already scandalous life. It wasn't long after Jeanne's death that the French courts actually reversed her conviction in an attempt to use the scam to vilify and take down the Queen, who was on house arrest awaiting her trial. And just a year later, Queen Marie Antoinette would finally face her own downfall, being found guilty of treason and executed by guillotine in 1793. Jeanne de Lamotte's deceitful actions and bold accusations against the Queen played a considerable part in tarnishing the image of the monarchy, contributing to the sentiments that eventually led to the beginning of the French Revolution and the end of the royal reign in France. But that, my friends, is a story for another day. Well, there you have it. That's our take on the fake countess and her gutsy diamond scam that changed the course of French history. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode, and thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to give us a follow on socials @Haunted History Pod, and we will see you next time on Haunted History.